I want to reflect upon your guys' really quick, what you guys kind of experienced and found in your Emperor papers. How did it go? Difficulties, struggles, excited things that you found, surprises, etc. Tatterfield?
This made me really want to do biographies for other figures that I'm really interested in, like some of the fathers. I just thought that having those on hand, like going through and doing a biography, even prior to doing some of the primary sorts of things, it's just a really good idea.
That's awesome.
So I kind of experienced that. That was unexpected.
That's very cool. That's very cool. Yeah, you just, and that's one of the things. I was talking to somebody yesterday, and they're worried that the stuff we're going through right now is not directly impacting their in particular book. And I was like, no, you've got to keep the big picture in mind. The whole purpose of this first month and a half, 2 months of lectures of me talking through Roman history is to prepare you with the structure so that whenever you start giving your presentations and you start diving into your book, that you're going to have a world with which you're able to interact with. That's the whole goal. So even doing these types of papers, this is preparatory work to get you to the point where you're actually able to make deeper insights and interact with the text in a deeper way. Yeah, that's awesome. That's cool. Other stuff, yeah.
It was really interesting because even though it's very simple, I was like reading through it and it was like, oh, the Palatine Hill, and I'm like, oh, I know what that is. Or like, what was the other? Oh, there was a triumph that they had, and I was like, oh, well, duh.
That's awesome.
Like a week and a half ago, what a bad idea.
That's a good feeling, isn't it?
It was good.
Yeah.
It was kind of comforting that I feel like I'm actually, I know what's going on.
Yeah, when you're reading through it and all of a sudden you're just like, and then Romulus, and you're like, hey! I know that guy. Yeah, that's awesome. Well, other stuff. Yeah, Bryce.
I just like dealing with the primary sources so extensively. Just because, I mean, I've dealt with primary sources before, but never so in so much depth. Mm-hmm. Especially like looking at more than one biography, like Suetonius and Cassius, and trying to merge the two because they are different.
Yeah.
Because I only used two journal articles. I didn't even use books or whatever, just because I had so much with the primary sources. So that was nice to not have to read about what somebody else says about the primary sources, go to itself and deal exclusively with that.
And that's what's awesome about your training here at Ozark, is that really you'll find that your hermeneutical training has set you up not just for theological studies, but for historical studies as a whole. You get into the primary sources and you know the questions you need to be asking. Okay, he's talking about the Dacians here an awful lot. What's the deal with the Dacians? Okay, I need to do some research on the Dacians so I can understand how to exegete this passage. Yeah, that's awesome. Very cool. Yeah, Mallory.
I feel like I learned a lot from like different resources that I used and stuff, but I always referred back to Suetonius. I feel like a lot of the information I had also came from the Suetonius paper and like just the different things. So I kind of felt like the two papers were very similar in a way because you wanted us to use Suetonius, and so I did, but like, I don't know, I just felt like some of the information was the exact same as Suetonius, and so like, you know.
Absolutely. And that's not a bad thing. That's not a bad thing at all. Now, I mean, if you turn to the exact same assignment, that would be weird. But ultimately, what you've done with the Emperor paper is you've extended what the Suetonius just scratched the surface for. Suetonius introduced you to the character, kind of put some cool stories around it, and then hopefully this paper you're able to kind of fill it out even further. That's the idea. My goal was not to just to say, write an Emperor paper and then, you know, good luck, you know,
yeah.
See you later. Hopefully you feel confident when you're doing this going, yeah, this is almost easier than what I think it should be. Good. That means you're doing it right.
That makes more sense then. Because I was kind of like, as I was writing, I was like, why am I doing this paper when I just did the Suetonius last week?
Because this is one of the reasons why, too. And this isn't a slight on anybody. This is just the way it is. Not many people would have read the entire chapter in Suetonius on their emperor if I had not assigned that. And that's going to be one of the things that prepares you so much to understand your emperor very keenly. Therefore, I have no problem if it's somewhat redundant, because that means you get it. Okay? Yeah?
Going to a couple different other articles, like in the IVP dictionaries and reading on Claudius, I was shocked to find that, like, I felt like I could have written the article having read Suetonius.
Yeah.
I thought, I knew all of that. That's nothing new.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the benefit of having read it over just going to an article.
Yeah. And one of the things that's interesting is what you'll also find is, because, like, you know, when you're doing an exegete in a passage, there's just so many sources you have to interact with and da-da-da-da. Roman history, they just don't have a lot of really good primary sources to give us great, deep pictures. We've got what we've got, and we just got to deal with it. That's why there's a raging debate right now about Domitian. We have biblical scholars that are claiming that Domitian was one of the most benevolent emperors around. And then you have some other people, biblical scholars, on the other spectrum saying he was killing Christians like he was swatting flies. Which one's right? Well, then you look into the Roman historians and they're going, both. It depends on who you're looking through. And I mean, the information we have on Domitian, we just don't have a lot. We've lost half of Tacitus. We don't get where he talks in depth and detail about Domitian like we would like. So what you're finding is what they're writing the articles is they're pulling all the resources that they can get, and primarily the problem is there's just not a lot. And you've read one of the key bulk ones of it on your emperor, and that's Suetonius. We're only missing the first, two chapters of Suetonius, so we lose a little bit of Julius Caesar, and the rest of it's intact. That's an amazing source. Other stuff. I saw a couple other hands. Yeah, Michael.
I was just looking at the wealth of knowledge and how to condense it into a digestible form of paper. Because I understand there's not the extensive knowledge that we would have on someone like George Washington.
Sure. But
there is a lot on these emperors. I mean, there's more than you can condense into, even 10 to 15 pages, let alone 4 to 6 pages.
Yeah.
So it helps us to focus the highlights and the most important things of what made them who they are.
Which may eventually become the points of conversation we were talking about. You know, everybody follow me on that? Yeah, absolutely. Wait till you have to do your 2-page summary at the end of the semester. Awesome. That'll be the hardest assignment all year. Other things? Good. I'm glad it was beneficial. All right, let's keep going. We have just finished talking about Remus and Romulus last week. We talked about the seven kings for the 244 years from 753 to 509. And 509 is the establishment of the what? The Roman Republic. The Republic of Rome. Yeah, Rome. No, that's 753 BC. You'll need to know the difference of those. It's 509 BC or 507. If you flub on the oral exam and say 507, I wouldn't count it off because it's debated. That's whenever the Republic was somewhat established. Instead of, and Michael, this will even kind of go to your comment, instead of me describing every single story that we have within the Republic, what I've decided to do instead was to list out seven different key political advancements inside of the Roman Republic. And in describing those advancements, I will talk about different events that happened during this time as well. Because my whole goal is to show what develops in the time period of the Republic that will eventually give rise, we'll talk about the shift in power into what will eventually become the full-blown emperor, which is also known as the Principate. Okay? If you hear this word, Principate, that's talking about the imperial rule of the empire as opposed to the Republic. Republic would have been, Republic. Republic would have been, the Senate-driven government, and this one's emperor-driven government. So if you ever see those two words, that's what's happening. This is the first time period, emergence of the second. So we'll be talking about what develops in the time of the Republic that eventually leads to the rise of the Principate. Republic, 509. One of the key things they develop is the Rome's adaptation, adoption of the gods. During this time period, we see the cultic avenue or the cultic aspect of Rome expand greatly. Because Rome, and we've mentioned this already, but I'm wanting to make sure I'm very clear of when this occurred and how this occurred. When Rome would conquer a different city or a different nation, the chief patron god of that city or of that region would be brought into the Roman pantheon. They would adapt, and the logic is very simple. If they had just conquered that region, it meant that the gods that were protecting those people have shifted allegiances to the Romans. And as a result, Rome is going to honor them by bringing them into their cultic worship. Because their imperial advancement has a lot to do with the favor of the gods, which we'll talk about by and by. A key example of this practice is Rome's victory over the Etruscan city Veii. Remember, we've talked about this one. How far away was Veii compared to the other two cities to Rome? This is the closest one. 12 miles. 12 miles. In the 5th century BC, 5th century, finally, Rome was able to destroy Veii. Many years of struggle with this little pocket of Etruscan existence finally is destroyed. And the key god or goddess over this city was the goddess known as Juno, the queen of the gods. Juno stood for vitality and youthfulness, and as a result, she had large implications on political and military strength as well. So whenever Rome conquers Veii, they take Juno and they actually allow her to be set next to Jupiter, who is the king of the gods. Instead of drastically rewriting things, they just graft her in, because what they've shown is that, obviously, she's shifted her allegiances to Rome, otherwise they wouldn't have won. So a major development, the way in which their pantheon develops, the different gods that they talk about throughout the Principate, throughout even Suetonius, points back to the time of the Republic when they're conquering nations and accumulating gods. Second, one of the key political weapons,
why then does so many of the gods correlate to, like, the Greeks?
Because whenever they accomplished, or whenever they conquered Greece, they got just more than just one god.
But I mean, like, why is Juno, since it's the era of Greece, why is that related to Veii?
Because how do you graft in, like, for example, you have Zeus, the king of the gods, and you conquer Greece in, you know, first century BC, and you've already got Jupiter in place, and now they have Zeus. What are you going to do? How are you going to graft in those gods? And you better be careful because you don't want to offend them. Well, what you start doing is saying, oh, actually, that was just a different name for this, when you start equivocating them. Or, if there's new ones, then, you know, sometimes they'll even sometimes use the name Jupiter and Zeus interchangeably. Not normally, because if you're a good Roman, you're going to be talking about the first name that was there to begin with. Nevertheless, whenever you have these multitude of gods, the reason why they parallel, how do you graft them into something that already exists? We have a king of the gods. Well, that's not a problem. It's not a problem. It just adds to the myth. That makes sense? Citizenship is the second major development throughout the Republic period. Citizenship. This is a huge political tool. Citizenship is a multitude of privileges within the empire, like tax exemptions or certain tax exemptions that a citizen of Rome would never have to pay. There are legal rights, you know, pertaining to, there are certain ways that you're even able to be capital punished reprimanded's too light. But the way in which you're able to be punished at all by the government, if you're a Roman citizen, it's different. Well, you even see this in the book of Acts. The fact that is it okay for you to be flogging a Roman citizen? Oh my goodness, didn't know you're a Roman citizen. You're my buddy now, you're my friend. In Philippi, I love that part, after they do that, and he's like, I'm a Roman citizen, by the way. And they're like, oh, okay, well then will you leave? After you escort me over to Lydia's house and I hang out for a while, and then you can take me out. I'm not just going to let you sweep this under the rug because you know you were wrong. Anyway, Roman citizenship. Legal rights, many other things along with Roman citizenship. Up until the 4th century BC, however, Rome really just had kind of a functional superiority. We are the citizens. But this is really developed as a political weapon to expand their kingdom in the 4th century BC. In particular, there was a city called Tusculum that was in a close proximity to Rome. And they were very hostile towards Rome. Now, Rome could go in and just wipe them out militaristically. Or Rome could try to graft them into their empire, especially since they're so close in location. You don't want to have enemies that close. What Rome decided to do instead was to offer them citizenship. They said, we will give you all the privileges of Rome. You will be considered one of us. You look at all the land we have, now would belong to you. All the privileges of a citizen now also belongs to you. And Tusculum says, fight or get all the benefits. And obviously, the leaders of Tusculum says, this is what we're going to do. We are going to be a part of the greatest empire that's existing. Well, that's not true. At that time, that wouldn't have been true. We are going to be a part of this empire that is growing. So instead of Tusculum trying to fight for themselves, they said, we'll be with you. And of course, the people down below are the ones that get punished, because whenever there's times of war, guess who Rome calls on to fight their wars for them? The citizens of Tusculum. Not the Tuscan elite, more than likely, because they still have to run the city. But the people that have now been subjected to Rome will eventually be the ones that are called into action. However, this use of citizenship was an amazing development in political political activity throughout the ancient world at the time. Greece did not use their citizenship in this manner. Neither did a lot of the other major empires. This empire in particular develops this action because they're trying to save resources. This is one of the things that frustrates me. We talked about this some yesterday with the persecution of Christians. It is ludicrous to think that if an empire is not wiping out an entire people, that they're just buddies with them. You want to try to maximize the amount of influence that you have with the resources that you have, because resources are limited. We are experiencing this right now with the wars that we're fighting in America, aren't we? This is something pretty interesting I heard not too long ago, that one of Osama bin Laden's strategies of fighting America, of undercutting America, he said, let's get them involved in so many wars that we'll bankrupt their nation. He said this like 15 years ago. And what's happening right now? Our economy, I mean, if you are a stockbroker, you're having an ulcer, because every single day you have 5% gain, 6% loss. Our economy is struggling because we're fighting so many wars. And guess what? There's even more wars that people are thinking we should be involved in. Like what eventually, what's going to happen with Libya? Or what's eventually going to happen with Iran? You see what's happening? You can't just fight every battle that comes. You have to have other ways of exerting dominance. And that's what citizenship was being used for. This is one of the ways that instead of fighting a war that's going to cost us a lot of money, we'll actually just expand our kingdom by allowing them some of the benefits. Very brilliant political tool. Something that if Greece would have latched onto, they may have actually been able to keep. Greece was not very good to the people that they conquered. They were brutal to them. And that's one of the reasons why whenever Rome came into some of the Greek regions, they were okay with switching sides. Because what was Greece offering them? But look what Rome's offering them. And that leads to the next one. Was there a question, or is your hand up, Wiley? Are you good? Or Michael?
Yeah, I had a quick question.
Yeah.
It's irrelevant, but did like the early empire, did they use a lot of conscripts, or did they use special soldiers?
It morphs. It develops. We saw, the sixth king, he eventually starts to pay the military, because before then, you had the people that could afford arms, the wealthy, were the ones that had the prestige of fighting in the military. Eventually, what we will find here in just a bit is that tries to start shifting. The more professional that the army gets, the more honor and dignity that it gets. And that the real professional army, although there are developments of it in the 6th century BC, really doesn't come to its full force until around the 1st century BC. And we'll the end of the 2nd, beginning of the 1st century. And we'll talk about that with a couple of different guys here, hopefully either today, maybe tomorrow. So there's different periods of the way in which the army was gathered. But definitely, always, even when there is a professional army, this is something that you need to know too. There weren't Roman legions in every single town. Matter of fact, at any given time, Roman legions, they averaged maybe 26 to 28 amount of Roman legions across the whole empire. Whenever they were fighting, especially on the edges, their key allies, their key way of fighting the war is developing what's called cohorts. And that is people that belong, that are subjected to the Roman Empire, they are also obligated to fight for Rome when Rome calls for them. So the cities on the edge of the empire were huge in times of war, because the legion would come, but the legion was primarily heavy artillery. They would be well-trained in siege weapons or sieges over major cities. But they would list horseback archers and things of that nature from the different cities that were around, because that's not what a legion was supposed to do. They were heavy artillery, and the other different types of little missile is what they would call those type of infantry and things of that nature. The spearmen, the archers, things of that, they would get from the cohorts. So there's kind of this twofold army. The professional one that's well-trained, and also the ones that they're not, it's not like these are random idiots that they just grab out of nowhere and they're like, hey, here's a weapon. You know, these people, you know, these cities that were conquered by Rome had their own armies that now Rome says, you'll fight for us when we call on you. And so that's kind of how they, again, to save cost. To save cost, which our model is much different. It's a strictly professional army. You can volunteer to go into it, but obviously the draft is a little bit of a cohort concept. But you know, theoretically, that's supposed to not happen anymore. But hey, you're clergy; you'll be fine. Number three, and this is related to the number two, but also one of the key things that develops alongside of the development of citizenship is diplomacy. Oh man, the Republic just gets incredibly acute when it comes to diplomacy. Matter of fact, many of the Roman historians call this and what we'll get to the very last one, which actually is kind of a secret hidden eighth development, the unity of Rome. But the diplomacy of Rome, they consider as the greatest political weapon of Rome, maybe even more so than the army. Although diplomacy doesn't work if there's no threat. It's just kind of the way diplomacy works. The army does help diplomacy, but diplomacy is the greatest weapon. Because again, when you have limited resources, you have to expand in other ways besides just killing people or doing sieges. And one of the ways of doing that is through diplomatic developments. Some of the key developments within diplomacy was not just citizenship, but partial citizenship. Sometimes they didn't want to oversaturate their Roman citizenship, that everybody has the perks, because if they did that, then they would not become a valuable tool anymore. If everyone was just a Roman citizen, it doesn't become a tool politically they can use to expand their kingdom. As a result, they would also offer partial citizenship. Partial citizens were allowed to enter into contracts with Rome for business. If you were not a full-fledged citizen or a partial citizen, you could not. Number two, if you're a partial citizen, you didn't have to pay some taxes on property. You get a little bit of tax breaks if you're a partial citizen. Or number three, if you married a Roman, you wouldn't have to forfeit all of your inheritance if you were a partial Roman citizen. So there are basically levels of perks that they could use as a way of getting people to stop fighting you and join you. Also, under diplomacy, the second thing, not just partial citizenship, but the second thing is, Rome would also at times allow for self-rule of particular regions. We'll let you rule, but you're still under Roman guidance. And this was a way in which for the people of a city to especially the ones in power, to hold on to their prestige and honor as the rulers of a city, and at the same time not be against Rome. To experience the perks of Rome and the perks of honor of being the ruler of a city. So this self-governing was a big thing for the social elites in the different areas that were subjected to Rome. We've talked about the key caveat. Number four, a major development in the Roman Republic was roads. And that's what the next picture actually is. In the 4th century BC, Rome found itself in this incredibly significant war with the Samnites. The Samnites. You'll even see sometimes different people that come from the Republic or times past inside of the Principate that'll have, they'll spit at them, kind of a thing. You know, kind of like in Acts chapter 2, whenever he brings up the Elamites and the Medes. If you're a Jew, you know what that's talking about. They're the two that helped take you into exile. And every once in a while you'll see Samnites pop up too, because that was a significant war that occurred in the 4th century BC. It was so significant because it almost threatened the very existence of Rome. It was during this war that the Roman road was developed. One of the most key military weapons that Rome developed in this time period was the roads. And this one right here is the Via Appia, the Appian Way. It stretches 132 miles from Rome all the way down into the region of the heel of the boot. And the significant development of this is now the army was going to be able to move across treacherous terrain. Like, notice that it actually crosses right, let's see if it'll help, let me, right here, it crosses where the Appian Mountains go. Because remember, the Appian Mountains comes from up here, goes all the way down into the toe. So this Appian, the Appian Way, the Via Appia, it actually crosses the mountains, allowing the army to swiftly move within a treacherous terrain. Development of the roads was a way in which not just to develop trade and communications, although it was used for that. Primarily, it was a weapon to develop a military strategic movements. That's why roads were created. And they were effective. The swiftness of which the Roman... we don't have time to go into this very much. Real quick, the Roman legions, with the amount of artillery they were moving and the fact that they could move 25 to 30 miles a day, number one, says something about how in shape they were, but number two, also the effectiveness of the roads. Because without the roads, you're not able to move 25 miles, 30 miles a day when you're carrying heavy artillery. It's just not going to happen. You'll move maybe 10 to 12 miles a day with heavy artillery. But the Roman legions were able to move quite swiftly thanks to the roads. And this will set the precedent for the other roads that we see that occur throughout the rest of the empire. The Ignatia, things of that nature. All the very first one, actually it's called the mother of the roads, the Via Appia. That's the one that occurs in the 4th century BC, a significant development time of the Republic. Number five, the universal currency. In the 3rd century BC, Rome began to develop this political weapon. A lot of times we don't think universal currency would be a political weapon, but it functions on multiple levels. Number one, this would streamline trade. Whenever you don't have to have currency conversion, you're able to actually streamline the swiftness and the ability, the flexibility of trade on multiple levels. So it helps fuel their economy. It helps bolster their prestige, their economy, their flexibility. Number two, it also it enforces dominance on their subjects. Because what you're saying is, now that you belong to us, give us all your money. You're not allowed to use that. You have to use ours. And every time they use one of the money, they're reminded of to whom they belong. And that leads to the third way in which the universal currency functioned as a political tool. It was a billboard for their imperial propaganda. You have a lot of the different... Right now, what is going to be covering the coins and during this time period, 3rd century, 4th century BC, 3rd century BC, is mythic heroes or gods or stories, but not people, not emperors, not key leaders, not politicians. It's going to be Romulus. It's going to be, does that make sense? The god Jupiter or Mars. That's who's going to be on the coins during this time period, because that's their propaganda they're trying to perpetuate. Money was also used during the Second Punic War as a way of making a political statement against Hannibal. We talked about Hannibal some last time. The dude was crazy. 220 BC, he just comes swathing through the Appian Mountains down to Rome, and he eventually comes all the way even down to here in the south of Rome. So much so that the south of Rome in 220 BC defected from Rome and ended up joining Hannibal, because that's how powerful he was proving to be. During this time where they're being out-militarized by Hannibal, where they're almost on the verge of financial bankruptcy as an empire, experiencing devastating and embarrassing losses by their armies, where Hannibal would be outnumbered like 5-1, but because he was so incredible with his training of his men and with his military strategies, he'd wipe out all the army of Rome. As a result, during this time period, as a way of making a statement to Hannibal, they minted for the very first time silver denarius, and they did it on a broad scale. Why? What does that say? How is that a political statement? During a time when you're almost hitting financial bankruptcy, what you do is, we are going to launch the single largest development of our coinage that heretofore has never been into existence. We've never done this on this broad of a scale. What is that saying? Say it again. Yeah, maybe it's a unifying statement saying, hey, we're in this together. What else would it be saying? Yeah, it's almost looking at Hannibal saying, oh, you've not even really made a dent in us. Oh, you think you have. It may look like that on the surface, but we're good to go. As a matter of fact, what we're going to do is we're going to develop a whole new different type of currency to plan for the future once we've destroyed you. What looks like a financial move is a very political one. They're not just developing the denarius to help their finances. They're developing the denarius to send a message to Hannibal that says, yeah, we've suffered some losses from you, but we're still here and we're not going anywhere. That'll build morale. And that's what it did. Number six, in the Republic period, we also had the development of gladiatorial events. Oh, thank goodness for Russell Crowe this happened. His career may never have made it where it was. 3rd century BC, during the same time of these Second Punic Wars, Carthage, that's who the Punic Wars are with. The First Punic War is with Carthage at the middle of the 2nd century, at the beginning to the middle of the 2nd century, and then the Second Punic Wars are with Hannibal and around 220, around that region. During this time, though, the Empire of Rome is getting weary. the expanses that are happening in the Punic War, their losses, the length of the war. This has been going on for 50 years or so now that they've been struggling with Carthage, both at sea and on land, with what's happening with him at this point. Basically, what was happening is this. The people of Rome were starting to say, enough of the wars. We're done. We've got to stop this fighting. This is just this wearing us out. It's destroying our empire, not helping it. But the politicians say we've got to figure out a way to redevelop the morale of the people that supports what we're doing, because ultimately our existence as an empire depends on it. So what they do is they bring the wars to the people and allow them to see it as a way of getting excited as opposed to something to rebel against. So they introduce the gladiatorial events where they reenact different wars, maybe even sometimes with a different result with Hannibal inside of these events in a controlled environment. And a lot of times they'd be filled either with professional gladiators or oftentimes prisoners, slaves, so that they're not killing their own people. And even though many people would describe this as horrifyingly brutal, the people of Rome and the Roman Empire as a whole loved it. It was exhilarating for them. As a matter of fact, it wasn't before long until the gladiator enterprise became the national sport of the Roman Empire. And what would that do? What would that do to the psyche of the empire? Say it again. What? Do you think sports are just for entertainment all the time? At any point in history? No. This is a political move. Gladiator events, it lets the people say, you know what, brutality is not so bad. Actually, it's kind of fun. And if this is what's really happening out there, that's exciting. All of a sudden, the morale behind the wars they've been fighting for 50 to 70 years starts to rebuild. They become, in a sense, desensitized to the concept of war or even the threat. Because when it's that close up and personal, well, it actually helps the political cause instead of hurts it. And I pointed this out before. Do you think there's a reason why all the language that surrounds the most popular sport in America today, football, is war language? The general, the quarterback, gets back, and they're fighting in the trenches so he can throw the deep bomb? Hello? Where did that language come from? Why is it there? Hey, if these people are going to like it, even the strategy. What's the strategy? You have the elite, the coaches on the side that are calling in the different strategic plays so that they can ultimately win the battle. Right? Gladiatorial events, more than just entertainment. Maybe a political tool. Number 7. And I can't wait till Peyton Manning gets back on the Colts so that we can actually have a chance of winning. Anyway. Number 7. Unparalleled brutality develops during the Roman Republic. This is probably somewhat of a carryover of what they saw with the Etruscans, maybe even the seventh king. But one of the things they realized was that unparalleled brutality, in a sense, can help them save resources. Crucifixion wasn't developed just because they're obsessed with suffering or making people cruelly killing them. Crucifixion sends a sound and very loud political message. We are the ones in control, and if you mess with us, you will suffer intensely. Why do you think it is that they always try to go after the leaders and they don't try to wipe out all the people? Because if you cut off the head of the snake, maybe the snake will just die. But the way that they do that, if they just merely killed the different leaders and didn't lead them in triumphs or even crucify them and things of that nature, then it may not have the sociological or the psychological effect on the followers of those people that seeing their leader that was supposed to be leading them in a rebellion is now hanging and suffering and being tortured. Unparalleled brutality does something psychologically that helps push your political agenda. Your ideology is driven by the fear that you can incite in the people that you're wanting to subject. And that's what the Republic really perfected. They got it. As a matter of fact, we see this in 146 BC. Notice all my examples have been going from the 5th century all the way up to closer to the 2nd century, which we're moving. 146 BC, the Roman consul, Mummius. Just takes me off guard. The Roman consul Mummius, he comes down from Macedonia with 4 legions because in the city of Corinth, they weren't too happy in 146 BC that Rome was claiming their dominance over them. As a matter of fact, there were a lot of anti-Roman slogans and anti-Roman acts happening in the city of Corinth. As a matter of fact, there were some politicians, Roman envoys, not even anybody primarily and particularly important, but attached to the Roman government nonetheless. They come to Corinth, not with anything big, just passing through. And Corinth beats the tar out of them. So what does Rome say? Okay, we're going to sick 4 legions on this city. And the legions come in and they don't leave an entire structure. All the structures in the city of Corinth in 146 BC were wiped out. Anybody that survived the massacre was sold into slavery. Not a single person was left in the city. And they take salt and spread it all over the city as a way of saying, you have just been judged by the gods. In the same year, 146 BC, the same thing happened to Carthage. Carthage had still been somewhat a thorn in their side from the 3rd century BC in the 1st and 2nd Punic Wars. Still having anti-Roman sentiments, even after they had won those wars, Carthage eventually got, according to the Romans, their just deserts. Whenever Rome came in with an overwhelming amount of an army, 4 to 5 legions, wipes out the whole city, and anybody that's left alive, sold into slavery, and salt is spread around. What they're sending to the message is this: we are in control, and if you're in our way, you will be mutilated, you will be destroyed. As a matter of fact, during this time period, many people in the Mediterranean world started calling this Roman imperialism, this brutality, the new wisdom. And the new wisdom was this: Rome was in power, and if you mess with them, you will feel their wrath. These factors developed in the time of the Republic, these 7 factors, led to the one key factor that even Polybius in the 3rd and 2nd century BC, even a Greek historian, writes, the reason why Rome succeeds is because of their unity. And these 7 factors put in an infrastructure so that not only can they expel, or they can exert their dominance over the people, but also that as an empire they can be unified even though they're so widespread. And it's their unity that ultimately leads to the downfall of the Greek empire. Questions, comments, concerns? We have 3 minutes. And we're going to dive into the rise of the Principate probably on Tuesday. Questions? Thoughts? Reflections? Now you can see what's in place. And guess what? These different tools, these different accomplishments that the Republic established will eventually be the very things that is used against them for the one person to seize control and will eventually call him emperor, imperator. Caesar, Augustus. Okay. You guys dismissed. Love you. See you on Tuesday.